Good afternoon. My name is Crystal, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Centers for American Progress press call on the Middle East. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Solner, you may begin your conference.
Thanks so much, Crystal, and welcome everyone to our call today. My name's Anna Solner. I'm the Vice President for Communications here at CAP. If you need to follow up with me after this call, my number's 202-492-2967. That's 202-492-2967. Just wanted to remind everyone that the call will be recorded, so you are, by participating in the call, you're agreeing to be recorded. The audio will be up shortly after the call. Today, we're bringing together three experts to discuss this pivotal week that's going to define the Obama administration's approach in the Middle East. You're all aware of the complex mix of issues crowding America's Middle East agenda, including popular uprisings and incomplete revolutions, the role Iran seeks to play as a hegemon, the Arab-Israeli conflict, the continued Iraq redeployment, and the future of U.S.-Iraq relations, and the way that the high oil prices and gas prices that many Americans are facing right now influence the domestic debate. The list really goes on, and so as you're doing your reporting this week, we're going to offer you today three perspectives on these events. Joining us is Brian Katulis. He's a senior fellow here at CAP. He's also served as a consultant to numerous U.S. government agencies, private corporations, and NGOs on projects in more than two dozen countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt. He lived and worked in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in Egypt for the National Democratic Institute for International Affairs for several years, and he's also lived and worked in Jordan. He is also the author of The Prosperity Agenda, a book on national security. Matthew Duss is a policy analyst and the director for Middle East Progress. He's joining us today from Tel Aviv, and he is going to be focusing on Iraq issues, which is the subject of the conference that he is in Tel Aviv on. Finally, Sabina Duan is the director of Globalization and International Employment here at CAP. She is focusing on the nexus between the development and security and the function of foreign assistance and capacity building in development. She actually will be hosting the first Just Jobs for Growth and Stability conference to be held in Cairo, Egypt next Friday. Brian, please kick us off.
Great. Thanks, Anna, and thanks for all of you for joining the call. I want to start out with the obvious point that what we say here on this call and some of the pieces that we have out on our website with recent analysis are obviously our own thoughts and in no way a preview of what the president is going to say. If you want that preview, there's a call. The White House is doing it for PM with the senior administration officials. So this is what our take is on sort of the dynamic set of issues in the Middle East. And I'm going to start out with just some overall points on U.S. Strategy in the region for a few minutes. And then Matt, who's joining us, as Anna said, from Israel, will offer some additional thoughts. And then Sabina will talk about what's going on in Cairo and in particular the economic situation there. First, clearly the president's speech tomorrow and then some meetings that he's having this week will set the framework for, I think, the rest of his time in office on the Middle East. This is a pivotal moment, and a lot of people are already talking about this speech is very, I think, very important. And I think in the aftermath of Osama bin Laden's death, President Obama has increased capital. He has increased political and policy capital. So people are going to be listening very carefully. And it struck me when we were in the region in February on a CAP delegation to Israel and on regular visits there that this notion that what the United States says does not matter as much or that the U.S. is a spent power really was not in touch with the reality of what we saw on the ground in places like Israel in February, where people were parsing and looking carefully at what the president says. So quite obviously, this is a historic speech, and what he says will matter. Second, and I think this is another clear point, is that what he says matters, but what they do matters even more. And I think the president has delivered a number of speeches, like the Cairo speech in 2009. His speeches at the UN General Assembly laid out general frameworks. But I think it's our task as analysts and those who are covering it in the media to really watch carefully in terms of what they do, because sometimes there are gaps between what they say and what they do. And in terms of the test of their strategy will come not in what simply what he says, but then what the follow-up is. And here I wanted to highlight what I think were three overarching points where I think there needs to be greater clarity and then also follow-up in terms of policy. Number one, I think the administration is pressed now to set some sort of context and framework for an overarching strategy for political and economic reform across the region. I think to date, the administration has adopted a pretty pragmatic approach in its public statements and speeches and its policies in recognizing that the status quo in the region is not sustainable. And I think when you look at the crushing economic, demographic, and political problems in the region and the lack of effective responses to that problem by many of the governments in the region, you've got a set of issues that are going to lead to an inevitable change in most of these countries. I think Egypt is a central test of the strategy, and Sabine is going to talk a lot about that. But I think Obama and his team need to present a more ambitious plan to help Egypt in this pivotal political and economic transition, because what happens in Egypt will clearly have an impact on other countries in the region. The second country I'd highlight is Iraq, where this has faded from sort of the headlines and our current debate. And I actually don't know that the president will speak much about this, but as our troops withdraw, there's going to be a need for continued follow-up on implementing the strategic framework agreement to help Iraq stand on its own and to build the bilateral relationship. And lastly, on this broader set of political and economic issues, I think the president will be pressed to offer a clear explanation on the responses in Libya versus the responses to Syria and Bahrain. And as we see in the last few hours, there's breaking news on perhaps more sanctions on Syria. But I think some of the difficult questions of how we respond in one place versus how we respond in another will be something that the president will try to address. And quite clearly, I think he did this a bit in his speech on Libya, but I think people want more answers, and there's a sharper focus on Syria these days. Two last points before I hand it over to Matt. I think, and it's my view, that as difficult as the Arab-Israeli conflict is and as complicated as that is politically and from a policy standpoint, with the September looming, the threat by the Palestinian Authority to unilaterally declare a Palestinian state and get a vote at the UN General Assembly, and also a growing campaign to try to isolate Israel through a boycott and divestment and sanctions, plus the events that Matt will talk a little bit about of the uprisings hitting Israel's shore over this past weekend, demonstrate that inaction or just treading water on the Arab-Israeli conflict simply won't do. That they need to multitask here and move forward on trying to deal with the complicated questions of restarting direct talks between Israelis and Palestinians and trying to revive the peace process. And then third and lastly, one last point on Iran. I think the administration has made Iran a top agenda item, and if there was a singular number one priority before the uprisings, it was the important steps that the Obama administration took to actually deal some real setbacks to Iran's nuclear program and isolate Iran and demonstrate to the world and to the Iranian people that the Iranian leaders have a choice here. So those, I think, are the three pivotal questions and issues. I think this is a time for the administration to be bold as opposed to thinking, you know, in terms of next tactical steps. And Matt's going to talk a little bit about Iran, Syria, and some of the things he's seeing in Israel.
Thanks. Thank you, so Brian, and thank you, Anna, and thanks everyone for joining the call. I just arrived here today in Tel Aviv, and in the very few meetings I was able to take thus far, it's already very clear the impact that the demonstrations of Sunday, on Nakba Day, of Palestinians demonstrating at Israel's borders in Gaza, in the West Bank, at the Golan armistice lines, and in Lebanon have made. This is the first time. This is the most serious unrest in the Golan in almost 40 years, and it's seen, I think, rightly as a clear attempt by Bashar al-Assad to demonstrate that if he's in trouble, he knows how to cause trouble. But at the same time, I think it really gets at the role that the Palestinian issue has and continues to play in the region. It's used both by authoritarian regimes as an excuse and as a tool to draw attention away from their own failures and their own troubles, but it also is a very real and very genuinely felt issue. And so I just to underline what Brian said about the importance of the issue, I think the Obama administration's analysis of the prominence and the role that this conflict continues to play has been correct. It's not the biggest problem. It's one of a number of problems, but still it's a problem that attaches itself to a number of other problems in the region. So I would really encourage them to continue moving forward in a not putting it on the back burner. As for Syria's relationship with Iran, I think there was initially, as these Arab uprisings started, I think initially there was an analysis that this would benefit Iran. I think it was a bit of a zero-sum analysis that saw U.S. allies in trouble, therefore Iran's benefiting. Months later, I don't think that is correct. I think it's clear that Iran's position has not been improved by these demonstrations. Its own claims to supporting freedom and supporting the rights of people in the Middle East have been demonstrated as pure hypocrisy as it's continued to clamp down on its own demonstrations. And its key ally in the Arab world, Syria, is now in serious trouble. And it's important to stress how important Syria is to Iran. It's their main bridge into the Arab world. And even though it doesn't look like Bashar al-Assad will be detaching himself from Iran anytime soon, his ability to function as a good bridge to the Arab world is diminished seriously already for Iran. So I think, as Brian said, the other measures taken by the Obama administration, the sanctions, there was the UN report, a special panel of experts last week that came out on the impact, the very serious impact that sanctions have had on Iran's ability to grow its nuclear program. And it's clear, and it was recognized earlier today by a senior Israeli defense official, that Obama's engagement, his attempt to talk to Iran about its nuclear program, actually had very important secondary effects. Even though there's no agreement that's been reached on the program, the international solidarity and the strong sanctions that President Obama was able to obtain in the UN Security Council as a result of having unmasked the Iranian regime as one that wasn't really willing to deal in good faith has been very, very important. So with that, I'll turn it over to Sabina to talk a little bit more about Egypt.
Great, thank you. I actually have some more general comments, and then I will talk a little bit about Egypt. But I think the first important point to note is that security concerns play a very important role in our approach to the Middle East and North Africa. But equally important are opportunities for income generation and broad-based economic growth. And overcoming economic challenges is really fundamental to promoting political stability in the region. I mean, let's not forget how all of this started with Mohamed Bouazizi, a 26-year-old vegetable vendor in a small Tunisian city who set himself on fire after his goods and scales were confiscated by local authorities, and he saw no other way for supporting himself and his family. Mohamed Bouazizi was really the Arab world's average Joe, and his self-immolation ignited the entire Arab world because his story resonated with the people throughout the region. And yet, there is surprisingly little attention given to the urgent need to create jobs, to create good jobs, or as we at the Center for American Progress like to call them, just jobs. Stability requires creating an environment where people can survive, and not just survive, but ultimately thrive. The Middle East and North Africa suffers from the highest youth unemployment in the world. Over 1 in 4 young people are unemployed in the region. Female youth unemployment exceeds 30% across the Arab world. The economic loss of youth unemployment is estimated to exceed 40 to 50 billion U.S. dollars annually across the Arab world. And this, in part, is the kind of economic loss that our foreign aid compensates for. So the questions that we really should be asking are, where will the jobs come from? How do we cut youth unemployment? How do we harness the productive potential of women in these economies? And as my colleague Brian mentioned, Egypt is a pilot to see what can be done in this space. What happens in Egypt in terms of job creation and promoting income generation opportunities for people matters to what will happen in the rest of the region. I hope that President Obama will do three things. One, I hope that he will make sure that promoting just jobs is an integral part of a comprehensive Middle East strategy. Two, I hope that our foreign assistance will focus on what is needed to foster job creation. Three, that the U.S. will work with other countries, that it will work and coordinate with other countries and international financial institutions like the World Bank to design good trade capacity building, investment, and other technical assistance programs to promote just jobs. I think if we're serious about harnessing the opportunities that the transition can bring, we have to address job creation. Finally, I want to announce that the Center for American Progress, as part of the Just Jobs Network, is hosting a conference in Cairo, Egypt, on May 27th to address exactly this set of issues. Although there are several challenges that are confronting countries in the Middle East and North Africa, we should sustain the optimism that underlies the Arab Spring by paying attention to jobs and opportunities for economic growth, in addition to focusing on security and political stability. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sabina. Crystal, we're ready for questions.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1, and we'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Michelle Plitnick with Enterprise Services. Mitchell.
That's right, Mitchell. I guess the question is for either Brian or Matt. Both of you have sort of indicated that there's a lot of attention being paid in the region to American policies, but how do you fit into that view? The Egyptian government, for example, opening its border with Gaza, a sense that the attention being paid to American policies is also a push for those policies to either change or to be defied if they're not in the interests or perceived interests of the people on the ground.
Hi, it's Brian. That's a very good point. I mean, first, you know, to be clear, as I understand, the security regime on the Gaza border with Egypt hasn't fundamentally changed. And in fact, Egypt was one of the places where the security forces over the weekend largely prevented demonstrators from getting up to the actual border, although I think a handful made it through and there wasn't sort of the violence there. What we're seeing right now, and I think this is a dynamic that was already seen as far back as 2006, is a region that is becoming much more assertive about its own interests. And it will actually try to advance sort of its interests as it sees fit. So Turkey is one example of this, where in certain instances, U.S. and Turkish interests and policies are closer in alignment, as in the case of Iraq. But they're not in alignment quite clearly on how to deal with the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I think the flotilla incident last spring demonstrated that there are serious gaps between the two countries. Another example quite clearly is Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has been pretty clear about their discontent with the way the Obama administration dealt with Hosni Mubarak's stepping down in Egypt, and also not happy with public statements made about Bahrain by Secretary of Defense Robert Gates in March when he visited there. I think this is a simple fact of the matter that the region has and had already for many years slipped into a complex multipolarity. It's one in which I think the U.S. Power and influence and ability to control events quite clearly, as of 2005, 2006, was not what it used to be in the 1990s. But it still matters quite a lot. And, you know, my observation at the top of our comments was, for all of this talk that nobody's really paying attention or listening to the administration, it strikes me on the in the region that people are very carefully watching what Obama said in the Cairo speech back in 2009, and they're looking to see what the follow-up on the policy and policy implementation is. And I think if there's gaps between what they perceive to be the rhetoric or what the president says in a speech and what the U.S. does, then I think a number of parties will be assertive in trying to advance their interests with or without the United States. That was happening already in the previous decade, and I think that will continue.
Matt, do you have anything to add?
Yeah. Sure, I'll just very quickly, I think it's, right, we're in a, you know, obviously a period of transition right here, and a number of actors in the region are sort of pursuing some of their own interests in a way that they haven't before. I think that's the sort of the nature of the moment, but in a kind of an aspirational sense, I think, and I think going back to the Cairo speech, it was implicit in there, and I think I would love to see the president make it more explicit, just, we've had this bargain with the rulers of the region for the past decades, and we understand now that that status quo was not sustainable. While there'll be more questioning of U.S. red lines and U.S. preferences to come, I think we should understand that America's goals and interests in the region are better served when these alliances are actually grounded in popular legitimacy.
Thanks so much. Crystal, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Howard LaFranchi with Christian Science Monitor.
I guess this would be for Brian. But anyone would be fine. Well, actually, it's a two-parter, if I could, and the second part would be, would be more probably for Sabina. But first of all, I guess the first question is one more of tone, or you know, comparing this to Cairo. I mean, will it be enough if we just get kind of an explanation of the president's approach, which has at least by critics been seen as, you know, leading from behind, not putting the U.S. Out in front, that you know, the change has to come from within. Will explanation of that be enough? And then secondly, I guess if I could ask Sabina, what kind of maybe economic measures? What would you like to see? What would be a good a focus on Egypt as a pilot case, as I think you indicated? What kind of announcement or maybe steps would you like to see on this, you know, on the important economic angle of what needs to happen in the region?
Great, Howard. Thanks. This is Brian. First, I think the speech will, nobody's really got a clear preview of it, but I think quite clearly he's going to talk about the Arab uprisings in the context of bin Laden's death and what this means for the death of the al-Qaeda ideology. And there was a lot of buzz before, you know, that leading from behind comes from the Ryan Lizza article in The New Yorker that was the week before sort of this dramatic event where Obama was killed. And in a certain sense, I think that was then, this is now. And I think President Obama demonstrated that he can move forward in ways when necessary, when others won't pull their weight. And I think the key point on the Middle East is this, is that as we, you know, as I was saying, the president should try to lay out a political and economic strategy for the region that is tailored to each of the individual countries. A key part of this is getting others, both in the region and then other global powers, to pull their weight and to demonstrate that it's not just about the U.S. So, you know, I think they've walked a very delicate line throughout the 5 months of the Arab uprisings of making sure that what was going on in Egypt or Tunisia and other places was not seen as a made-in-America crusade, which was the mistake, I think, of the Bush administration and its freedom agenda. I think similarly, when you look carefully at what was announced earlier this week on Jordan and OPEC and everything that's being done there, I think what they're trying to signal is that in a time of budget constraints at home, the notion of a Marshall Plan, capital M Marshall Plan, may be unrealistic, but the notion of a Marshalline Plan, as I would put it, a small m, of marshalling the resources of a number of global actors is key. This is what they're trying to do on Libya, and despite, in my own view, the inartful conception of leading from behind, I think that's central to how actually global politics and politics in this region will happen, in large part because you look at, the last thing I'll say, countries like Saudi Arabia that are oil-rich, that have tremendous cash reserves. Saudi Arabia has already announced $20 billion in terms of stimulus aid for Oman and Bahrain. I understand that they're about to announce even more packages for the region. I think a big part of the challenge is not how much more development assistance just coming from the U.S. or the World Bank, and this will lead into what I think Sabina will have to say on Egypt, but how do you get this region of the world much more connected to the global economic grid? That's the only way, I think, to grow jobs. And I think this notion of the U.S., you know, if we can't do it, nobody can, which I think exists still in sort of the minds of some neocons, is simplistically, it's simplistic and foolish. And I actually think getting others to pull their weight is a key part of this.
So on the economic side, I think I can start where Brian left off, which is, you know, how do you connect these countries to the global economic grid? And I think that is exactly what the United States, but I think the international community more broadly, needs to focus on. What does that mean specifically? I have four things that I can say should be on that agenda right away. Number one, the capacity building of ministries. In my conversations in Egypt with the transition government and with other labor leaders and business owners, there is a complete lack of both capacity and transparency in the ministries, and particularly the ministries that oversee investment and trade. And so that's a first starting point, is not just our foreign aid, but what can our Treasury Department do in terms of working with other ministries and building their capacity and their understanding and of the risks associated with investment and how to overcome those risks. Second, we need to bolster the capacity of the small and medium enterprises in Egypt, for example. Most of the job creation comes from small and medium enterprises and not big multinational corporations. So how do we bolster the capacity of the small and medium enterprises? I think there's more work to be done in that space. Third, we can focus on building capacity to trade, so trade capacity building, and look at beyond the QIZs to what other areas there might be to expand trade with Egypt. And fourth, we need to work with other countries in supporting innovative programs for youth training, for example, and to look into beyond just the industrial sector, what potential opportunities there are in services and especially agriculture. I think Egypt in particular has enormous opportunities for enhancing agriculture, and exploiting those opportunities, I think, is important for the country to be on an upward trajectory of economic growth.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Crystal, do we have any other questions?
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star 1.
If there are no further questions, I'd like to invite our speakers to make any final comments. Any final comments? Great. Well, once again, I'd like to just thank you all for being on the call. If you need to reach me for any follow-up questions, my name again is Anna Solner. My number is 202-492-2967. That's 202-492-2967. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. The audio will be posted shortly.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.